Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today we're getting to know regional health providers, and joining us now in SDPB's Black Hill studio, regional health surgeon, Dr. Jacob Weasel. Dr. Weasel, thanks for stopping by today.
Yeah, thank you, Lori, for having me on.
I want to go back. We were talking with Dr. Kenny earlier about surgery, and he was talking about robotic surgery. But one of the things that stuck out to me is just how long it takes to get the knowledge and the skills and the education and the certifications and the years that goes into this that go into this journey. So start by telling me a little bit about when you first became interested in medicine. What was the pull for you?
Yeah, I think going back, you know, I felt when I was 16 years old that, number one, I felt a calling to medicine. I felt a calling to surgery in particular. And it kind of just opened up a new world for me. And I was fortunate enough that I had opportunities to shadow different doctors. And, you know, one thing led to another, and I was afforded opportunity to go to Creighton University, where I was awarded a full ride scholarship. And, you know, every step along the journey that I continued to take, I think that my passion just increased and increased for the practice of surgery and the practice of medicine. And like I said, I was fortunate enough to have opportunities arise and doors open for me. But you're right, it's a long process. And my wife would tell you from her standpoint as well, it's equally long for the family.
Yeah. So a full ride scholarship and some of those doors that open is a huge opportunity. We can't deny that. But it also feels, I'm guessing, like a responsibility at some point when somebody, you know, has that kind of faith in you to say, you know, you've earned it, you've earned the, you know, the financial awards and such, but boy, you can't mess up then. Do you feel a sense of pressure as you sort of took each next step?
Yeah, I don't know if I would say pressure. You know, I think each step builds upon the other. And so you go to undergrad and you think that your schedule is heavy and that you're working a lot. And for me, I was married young, and my wife and I started having children young. So I had a family of five going through undergrad and going through medical school. And each step kind of builds upon the other, though. I think that when I see patients that come into my clinic, the one thing that I always tell nurses or providers that I speak to is that it's a privilege, and we should never lose sight of the privilege that we have as providers when our patients come and entrust their health and, in certain instances, their lives and place them in our hands. That's quite a responsibility, and it's really the privilege of a provider to be able to offer help to our patients.
You're an enrolled member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, and your grandmother was a nurse for Indian Health Service in Montana. Tell me about your grandmother, and what was your relationship like with her?
Yeah, so my grandmother, she was an amazing person. She was a role model. She was an inspiration for me. She had a difficult background, as did my father, as do so many Native children growing up on reservations. But, you know, she overcame all of those obstacles and served her community as a nurse for many decades. And, she was part of the inspiration for me to pursue medicine. And I just remember spending summers up on Fort Belknap Reservation in north central Montana, hanging out with my cousins. And, that from the time that I was 16 and felt a call to medicine, I knew that serving Native people was always going to be part of my dream and my goal. And that's really part of what led me to come and serve Rapid City and the surrounding area, is the ability to serve the Native community.
So much when we talk about education and Native kids is there's the woven in are these ideas of expectations and what you believe that you can do and how to, you know, deliver on that for Native youth across the state of South Dakota and beyond. Did you have a sense that, that you were trying to achieve something as a Native kid that other people thought that you wouldn't be able to accomplish?
You know, I think from the time that I was young, my dad, he just instilled in me, both of my parents, a hard work ethic. And not that there are two standards. I think that in some instances, there are double standards for Native people, that we think that it's good enough for a Native. And that was never the instance in our home. My dad always taught us to do your best and to do the very best that you can, regardless of who you are, to be the best person that you can. And I think that for me, coming to Rapid City, part of my dream and my goal is to be a role model for Native kids, that whether they want to be a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, whatever it is they want to do in life, they can do it. And to kind of break down some of those barriers and some of the stereotypes, to for young kids to just realize that they have just as much potential as anybody else.
What do you tell those kids when you're talking to them about your experiences with racism? What do you think is useful to pass on?
I think that the main thing is, you know, you can't affect other people's behaviors in a lot of circumstances. All you can do is affect your behaviors and your perspective. And I think keeping a good perspective on things is one of the important things. And the other thing I would say is that the only time that we grow in life is through challenges and difficulties. And, you know, a lot of Native kids have a lot of challenges to overcome, but that also means a lot of opportunity. And my dad would always say that, you know, you can look at challenges as either obstacles or opportunities. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for growth that's out there for Native kids, that we need to stop seeing them as obstacles and start looking at them as opportunities for growth.
You see a lot as a surgeon, as a healthcare provider. Tell us a little bit about some of your philosophies. We've talked, you know, I teased a little bit before you came on about this notion as food is medicine. Where does that interest come from, the sort of interest of what's on our plate?
Yeah, so you know, I've always had this interest. I've always been health conscious, whether it's just with my wife and my kids and our family, or talking to, you know, my parents. But I think you go back to Hippocrates, who had this notion that, you know, food is medicine. And I think that if you look at the majority of chronic debilitating illnesses in this country today, a lot of them are preventable diseases that can be solved a lot of times through diet and exercise. And I think especially illnesses that are plaguing Native American communities. So I think that, you know, as a surgeon, I've had discussions where I can operate every day for the next 40 years of my career, but if I can alter the way that people choose their foods and alter their diets, I think that will have an even greater impact than what I could do through my career. And so I think, you know, health does start with everyday choices, and a lot of that has to do with what we find on our plates at dinner time.
That can be a hard thing to parse out when you, for example, if you go to the library or bookstore, you're going to see all kinds of advice of, you know, this diet and that diet.
Right.
You can get lost in that research. Do you just take it back down to its basics? How do you sort of get people started when they're overwhelmed about food and they know that what you're saying is true, but they don't know what to do next?
Right. And I think this is one of the problems that we've had, is that we've made something so simple as eating dinner an extremely complicated matter, to where some people are paralyzed, you know, from the amount of information that's out there. And what I usually tell patients is, number one, I don't necessarily believe in fad diets, but I believe in food diets. And so I think that anything that your grandparents would recognize as food is okay. I think the main problem is that you see a lot of processed foods and refined carbohydrates on our shelves today that are really good because they are able to be stocked for a long time and they have shelf life. But what I tell patients is anything that came from the earth that was meant to be food is okay. And that means that if you want to have a steak, you can have a steak. If you want to have potato chips, as long as it came from a potato and was cooked in oil, then you're okay. Obviously, you have to have all things in moderation. You know, if I would say anything, I would say a whole food diet from things that are recognized as food and less refined sugars and processed foods.
Do you see the results of what, you know, you might call the typical American diet in the operating room? Can you, is it something that shows up in your daily work, or is it more of a life philosophy that you have?
No, and this is why I think a lot of surgeons feel so strongly about the issue, is because it makes every aspect of what we do more difficult. You know, obesity has many repercussions to patients' health, but in an operating room, it just all around makes surgery a more difficult thing to do, whether it is the surgery itself or whether it's post-operative cares with higher rates of wound infection, you know, higher rates of hernia recurrences, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all around, I think this is an issue that needs to be tackled, not just from the surgeon's perspective, but just in public health in general.
You mentioned your wife and sort of the long, you know, and your children, the long hours and the training that has to happen. You know, for young folks in medical school who are trying to embark on this career, how do you hold a family together when you have the kind of job that you do?
Yeah, I think, you know, the main thing that I would tell somebody that's going through med school that's trying to be a husband and a father on top of a student and then later on in their career trying to be a well-rounded, competent physician is that you just have to, number one, cherish the time that you do have. And so a lot of it has to do with quality of time and not quantity. You know, setting expectations early, and it's I've been blessed to have a wonderful spouse who understands what I do, and, you know, allowing your kids to share in your life, coming home, and my kids recognize what it is that I do, and we share with each other around a dinner table about what we did during our day, and they have a recognition of understanding what it is that I do every day, and they understand that they have a part to play in that as well, and that their sacrifice doesn't go unnoticed.
Mm. Tell me about moving to the Black Hills and regional health, and sort of, have you found a place that you feel like is home? Is it what do you love about this region?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I never have lived here throughout my life, but it does kind of feel like coming home. My parents had initial plans to come to Rapid City initially after my father had graduated from Bible college, and they ended up going down to New Mexico. And so I was raised in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and later on Omaha, and did training in Des Moines. So this coming back to Rapid, this is the first time that I've lived here, but it almost feels like home. I brought my family here on vacation 4 years ago, and we fell in love with the area. And when I sat down with my wife and looked at places where we wanted to end up, I knew I wanted to serve Native people. I love being outdoors. I love going hiking and fishing with my kids and with my wife. And so this was obviously kind of a no-brainer. It was automatically at the top of the list of places that we wanted to end up.
When you talk about serving Native families, are there innovative ways that you're finding? Are there opportunities that maybe you didn't expect that, you know, you got here and you thought, I'm going to be doing this one thing, but wait, that there's more doors open than I realized to sort of fulfill that mission?
Yeah, I think that, you know, an acknowledgement of historical trauma and an acknowledgement of what's happened in the past, as well as bridging the divide. What my goal is and what my dream would be is to be a bridge, a liaison between the medical community and the Native community. I think that there's been a disconnect in some regards going back several years, and if I can in any way help to heal that and bridge that divide, you know, that's one of the areas that I've found opportunity in.
How difficult is it to rebuild trust?
You know, it takes time. I think it's a very difficult thing. And like I said, it takes time, and it takes, you know, having the right intentions and doing the right thing every single day. And so when I have patients in the ER that come from Pine Ridge or come from Rosebud, I don't treat them any different than I would anybody else. I treat all my patients with the best care that I can possibly provide. And I think that over time, I think that perceptions are going to change. And hopefully a lot of that that trauma will be healed over time.
Does it make a difference to those patients? Do you hear feedback from them and their family? Do they connect with you on a different level than maybe they would, you know, speculatively of another surgeon?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think that for those that are hesitant or those that have had difficult experiences in the past, I think it's a good thing when I come into the room and I can talk with them about family members that I have on the res and about my experiences growing up and spending summers on the reservation. And there is a bond and a trust, I think, that other people might not have the ability to have.
You mentioned historical trauma, and I'm wondering how you see that sort of manifest itself as a medical provider.
I can speak, you know, when I was at Creighton University getting my undergrad degree, I was studying public health and I came across a study of Native American women that were sterilized without any informed consent. And the federal government up to this point accepts about 3,500 Native women in the early 70s that were sterilized without informed consent. And other estimates are somewhere in the 20,000 range. And so I look back, and that was kind of my mother's generation, and I have aunts that are kind of within that time frame. And I think that, you know, that generation, it doesn't surprise me if that there's a bit of hesitancy when they come to a hospital just because there is distrust based on actual things that have happened in the past. And like I said, I think it's only time that's going to allow those wounds to be healed and rebuilding that trust as providers.